All right, if you want to get your notes out, we're going to get started with the teaching this morning. We're starting something new. We're going to be in the new year. Pardon me. We're going to be going through the book of Ephesians, the whole book, so it'll take us a few weeks. Six chapters, going to kind of do verse by verse, but we're going to start there today. Today's going to be a little different, where I usually do a lot of scripture. Today, we're going to do a lot of history with a little bit of scripture, because what I want to do is, before we look at the book of Ephesians, I want to really take you to Ephesus. I want you to really get a feel for what it would be like to be in Ephesus before we begin to look at the letter that Paul wrote to Ephesus. And then what we'll do after that, next week we'll kind of do a flyover of Ephesians, sort of an outline, and then we'll come back after that and begin to go line upon line through the book of Ephesians. So it would not be a bad idea for you to include Ephesians and maybe even Colossians as kind of a parallel book in your Bible reading here in the new year, so that you have a clue what I'm talking about. Because if you're like me, you forget stuff you've read lots of times unless you've read it recently. Amen? Now, the other thing I want to do, I'm going to use this opportunity to go on an intended rabbit trail. Because the rabbit trail will be a passage out of Timothy, the much debated passage about whether or not women need to be silent in church. So we're going to find out whether Sandy was grossly out of line this morning or not when she came to the mic. Okay? And here's why I'm doing this. I'm doing this because it directly, or the understanding of this passage is directly impacted by a study of Ephesians, and so it just seemed like a good time to do it. Also, it's kind of been in the news in the last few months. I'm not going to get into personalities and names, but it's come up, and a pastor has come out and reiterated their commitment to, you know, not allowing women to teach and shut it and all that stuff. And then other guys came out and answered him. And so it's just kind of been in the news. And, of course, the third reason is Rachel's out of town today. But my mom and my sister are here, so I probably still need to be good. So we'll get to that, but to get there, to really understand this passage in Timothy that we're going to go to, you need a pretty good understanding of Ephesians and of the history of Ephesus. So today, we're just going to talk about the city of Ephesus, and it has really significant just impact on the New Testament, the Bible, I think more than we realize. Most of this stuff is just Bible history. So I'll give you the references in your notes, but I'm not going to go there and read it because it's probably pretty familiar to you. A lot of it's in the book of Acts. But maybe in your mind you haven't pulled it all together and realized how big a deal Ephesus was to the early church. So today, by the time we're done, hopefully you will. All right, so Ephesus. Let's just get the particulars out of the way, just a few basic things to learn about the city of Ephesus. Ephesus was a lot of the stuff I'm giving you, remember, it's 2,000 years old, so there's debate. There's guys with PhDs who spend hours debating this. A lot of these things I'm going to say, so I'm not going to debate it that long. But it was a major, possibly the capital of Asia Minor, major port city, right there on the Aegean. Now, the Aegean is the body of water between modern-day Turkey and Greece. Okay, so it's right there on the Aegean. It's a port city in Asia Minor, as Paul refers to as Asia Minor, today Turkey. And it had a population of estimates run between 1 and 200,000 people. Now, to give you an idea, that's roughly the population of Melbourne and Palm Bay. So it's a pretty good-sized city for, zero-ish A.D., or 50 AD, or wherever we're looking at it, all right? So this is a good-sized city, and being a port city obviously meant trade by ship, but also it had three major roads going out of it. One went north, One went south on the coast. One went east, heading towards Babylon. So it was not just a port city. It was a hub of travel. So caravans could come in and out. You could get stuff on the boats. You could buy your things from, you know, wherever. You could bring in your stuff from Babylon. You could buy your stuff from Greece and from Rome, and all that was going on. So it was a very trade-oriented city, so it was a very wealthy city, a very wealthy city. Think, you know, I don't know, Vieira or, you know, I don't know what we have around here, but it was a wealthy city. So there was wealthy areas. I'm sure there were less wealthy areas, like every city, but this was a nice city. This is a wealthy city. There was a lot of trade, a lot of wealth. To reflect that, you read about, as you're looking into the history of Ephesus, you read about that time. They had aqueducts that brought water into the city. They had a notable library. Not every city in that age did. They had an amphitheater that seated about 25,000 people. That's the equivalent of probably a modern basketball stadium. College football usually seats 80 to 100,000 because football is just better. But so more people go. But you know how it is. So they had this huge amphitheater. And so not only is it a trade center and a wealth center, it's a center of culture. And so it's going to have a bigger influence on Asia Minor than other cities because it's a cultural center. It was founded as a Greek city, really pre-Greece, but its influence as it grew was as a Greek city. So it's really a Greek city. Now, it's under Roman rule because Rome is basically ruling the entire Mediterranean at this point, right? But it's not Romanish as much as it's Greekish. It's a Greek city that Rome is ruling. So it has some Rome things going on. I think they had some games there occasionally and stuff like that. A few gladiators, you know, whatever team was in town. But it's basically a Greek city. And that's important to understand because that Greek influence is going to come into some of our interpretation when we get to that passage in Timothy. And it's the biggest deal is this. They had the temple of Artemis. If you're Greek, it's Artemis. Diana is the Roman name of this goddess. So Artemis, Diana, same chick. Two people referencing her. They had the temple of Artemis. Now, this was a big deal. I cannot emphasize enough how big a deal this temple of Artemis was. It is one of the seven ancient wonders of the world. I don't know if you knew that, but the temple of Artemis is listed as one of the seven ancient wonders of the world. It was huge. It was four times the size of the Parthenon. Now, the Parthenon was the temple to Athena in Athens. If you don't want to go to Athens, you can go to Nashville, and they have a replica Parthenon there. Anybody seen that? Okay, a few of you. Okay, it's pretty cool. But it's big. So this was four times the size of the Parthenon, which almost everyone's heard of. It was very big. It was a very big deal. We're going to get into this a little bit more, but the Temple of Artemis being there, the worship of Artemis was a big deal in the city of Ephesus. Okay? So let's jump to the significance of Ephesus in the early church, all right? And so what we're going to see is Paul's relationship to Ephesus. We're going to find that probably Paul spent more time in Ephesus than anywhere else. It's debatable whether he spent as much time in Antioch, but on his missionary journey, certainly, he spent a long time in Ephesus. So let's just go through that, and again, you guys have read the book of Acts, so I'm just going to be summarizing some history that you probably know. So on Paul's second missionary journey, and this is, just to put it in context, this is just after the Jerusalem Council, where Paul and Barnabas had come back and they said, hey, we're getting Gentiles saved, what do we do about circumcision and stuff like that? And the Jerusalem Council said, you know, let's not make them do that. Let's just tell them not to eat meat sacrificed to idols and to be holy, and, you know, Jesus seems to have taken care of it, right? So that's the Jerusalem Council, Acts 15. You guys remember that. So immediately after that, Paul and Barnabas go out, and they begin this second missionary journey. And this is the one where Paul and Barnabas at some point will get in a dispute over John Mark, who Barnabas, the son of encouragement, wants to keep nurturing. And Paul goes, no, the dude blew it. He's out. Let's leave him. Let's send him home. And they remember they split, and Barnabas takes John Mark, and Paul takes Silas with him. So that'll happen in this journey. Interestingly, though, just so you know, later on, I forget which letter, later on in one of his letters, Paul asks for John Mark. So apparently John Mark worked out, and Paul asked for him back. Anyway, that's the journey. So we start on this journey, and Paul immediately goes to Asia Minor. Now, Paul grew up in Asia Minor. He was from Tarsus, which is in Asia Minor. And on his journey, early on, he picks up a young man named Timothy, who is going to be a bigger deal than we realize in Ephesus. All right, so he picks up Timothy in Acts 16, and Timothy, from this point forward, is a disciple of Paul. And what I want you to see is for the next roughly 10 years, anywhere Paul goes, Timothy is there. Occasionally he would send him ahead or have him lag behind and catch up, but pretty much for the next 10 years, wherever Paul goes, Timothy goes. Timothy is Paul's disciple. All right. Now, we see this on Paul's second missionary journey. It's on this journey that Paul writes his first and second letter to the Thessalonians after he gets to Greece. We'll get there in a minute. And in each of those letters, he writes them from himself and from Timothy. He notes Timothy is with him. So we see Timothy is on this entire journey. Now, after he goes through Asia Minor, he jumps across the Aegean and goes to Greece. And here's what he finds in Greece. He finds some success, but also a lot of resistance to the gospel. And a lot of it is the Jews. They actually would follow him from one town to the next and stir up the crowds and get everybody rowdy. Of course, you know the story. When he's in Philippi, he ends up in jail, right? Just because he casts a devil out of a woman who has a spirit of divination. And the powers that be are losing money now, and so they're upset, so they put him in jail, and he gets beaten. You know the story of Paul and Silas in jail? The kids sing songs. It's all fun. Anyway, we won't go through that. He had a really good attitude. So he goes through Greece. Gist of it is he's getting some resistance, some persecution, and on his way back, he comes back across to Asia Minor, and he hits Ephesus. So this is his first time as a missionary in Ephesus. I don't know if he ever went there as a boy, but this is his first time as a missionary in Ephesus. And it's interesting because he's received in the synagogue, and they encourage him to stay. So Paul, not only do they like him, they say, why don't you stay and keep talking? And he says, no, I can't do that. I need to get to Jerusalem for the feast, but I'll tell you what, I'll come right back. And so that's what he does. He goes to Jerusalem for the feasts, end of his second missionary journey, turns around, Paul's third missionary journey, and he pretty much heads straight to Ephesus. Now, he hits a couple towns in Asia Minor on the way, goes through Asia Minor to get to the coast, but it looks like he kind of does a beeline to Ephesus. I'm going back to this town where they want me to speak in the synagogue, and that's what he does. And when he gets there, he's actually there, Acts 20 tells us, he's there for about 3 years. He spends 3 years in Ephesus building up the church of Ephesus, okay, which is significant. Paul hasn't spent 3 years anywhere, and he won't again, except for close to that when he's in jail. But he spends 3 years there, and I put dates on this, but this is another thing that theologians argue about, so I've done the best I can, but don't, you know, hold me to this, maybe off a couple days. But it's been 2,000 years, so lighten up. But I did put some rough time frames in just so it helps. It's a little bit easier for you to track what's going on, okay? So this is roughly, Paul's in Ephesus, roughly AD 52 to 55, okay? So you have that time frame as we go forward. Now, he spends 3 months teaching in the synagogue, and he's doing well, but at some point after 3 months, they start to get annoyed at whatever he's teaching. So he says, great, I'm out of here. And he goes to the school of Tyrannus, and he spends 2 years teaching in the school of Tyrannus. I don't know anything about this school. They don't tell us anything about this school. It sounds vaguely dinosaurish, but doesn't it? I figured that was their mascot, maybe. you know, the football team, the Tyrannosaurs. The School of Tyrannus, don't know anything about it, but it's a school, and Paul's teaching there for 2 years. So for 2 years, I want you to imagine this. The Apostle Paul, for the next 2 years, is teaching at the college formerly known as BCC. And you can go down there, you could take a short drive and take classes with Paul, right? So this is right here in town. This is pretty cool. So Paul is having a tremendous influence on the Ephesian church. Now, in Acts 19, there's a bunch of stuff, and it's easy to forget that all of this is happening in Ephesus. So I want you to imagine Paul's teaching at Florida Eastern State something. And thank you. I guess it's just always BCC because that's stuck in my head. So I appreciate the help. Anyway, once you imagine Paul's in there teaching and these things are happening in Palm Bay, and what influence might that have on the church? So here's what we read in Acts 19. First, unusual miracles are being done by his hand. This is the handkerchief thing, where people would sneak in after Paul's been making tents and wiping sweat off his forehead and steal his handkerchiefs and go heal people with them, right? So Lori could go and get a handkerchief for the healing room, and if she could catch Paul after he made a tent. So that's going on. The Jewish exorcist thing's going on. The seven sons of Sceva, where they go, they try and cast out a devil by Jesus whom Paul preaches. And remember, and the devils go, yeah, we know Paul, but we don't know you, and we're going to beat you. And the guys, the seven sons, end up running away naked. So it tells us two things. You got to know Jesus to cast out devils. But also that they watched Paul, and they figured, we can cast out devils. Why? Because devils were being cast out. So we know unusual miracles are happening, and enough devils are being cast out that local itinerant exorcists think, I can do that, and start trying to cast out devils and get a beat down. We read that there were many converts, and in fact, at one point, the converts came together and gathered their magic books and burned them because they're done with magic now. And it tells us the value of the books. And it's if you put it in today's value, figuring a daily wage of about $100. So you're making $500 a week. For the average person, it's making $500 a week. For college people, that sounds exorbitant. For those of us with houses, it doesn't sound like that much. It comes out to about $5 million. So imagine that. We're meeting tonight at the, Vieira Stadium, and we're going to be running $5 million worth of magic books. That sounds like an interesting service, doesn't it? All right? But again, what I want you to get from this, a feel for what it is like to be in Ephesus. They had this culture, this city, this cultural center had $5 million worth of magic books. They were really into their magic. They were very spiritual, but in very odd ways, right? And again, we have the Artemis thing that we'll get to in a minute. So Paul is in the midst of this. And here we go with the Artemis thing. The other thing that we read about, in Acts 19 was just before Paul leaves, he's been there for 3 years, and he's fixing to go over and see how the churches in Greece are doing. Just before he leaves, there's a riot, and the riot actually spreads to, it ends up in that amphitheater that seats 25,000. I don't know how many people came to the riot that day, but it was a big event. And is over this silversmith, Demetrius, and he starts the riot because so many people are getting saved. Him and lots of artisans are making a living by fashioning both coins with Artemis's figure on them out of silver and silver statues and just all the things you need for, pagan idol worship, right? And so their living is in jeopardy because all these people are getting saved. So not only are they burning their magic books, they're pitching their silver idols, or at least they're not going to Demetrius and buying new ones. And so he's having such an influence on Ephesus that Demetrius and the other people are upset, and they start a riot. Now, As riots go, I don't think most of the people that ended up in the riot knew Demetrius or how they got into the riot, but at some point you're just having fun and it's just sort of a crowd thing. So they end up in the theater, and it says this is in the Bible, not lying, says that they began to shout because they were being, somehow they figured out, hey, somebody's, threatening the glory of Diana, of Artemis, who we worship, whose temple is in our city. This is, and so they're going to have a pep rally, and they shout for 2 hours, great is Diana of the Ephesians. When's the last time you came to a worship service and did the same song for 2 hours? Right? They were fired up. Again, imagine that, 2 hours just shouting, great is Diana of the Ephesians. And they talk about us repeating song lyrics. So this is pretty heavy. They are really, I'm telling you guys, they are really into Artemis or Diana, depending on the Greek or the Hebrew or the Greek or the Roman name. And so they have this huge riot, right? So again, want you to get a feel for the culture of Ephesus and the importance of Ephesus. Paul just spent 3 years there. So he's having a huge impact on Ephesus. Now it's at this point, Paul heads for Greece. It wasn't because of the riot. The riot just was kind of a going away present for Paul. It just happened at that time. So, maybe he was having it too easy. In Greece, he got persecuted a lot. So he heads to Greece to check on how Corinth and the churches over there are doing, Thessalonians, all those guys. And then he is heading to Jerusalem. Now, at this point, Paul knows something. I think he knows that he's headed to Rome via Jerusalem. He's not totally sure how, but it sounds like it's going to be sort of forced. So Paul is in a hurry to get to Jerusalem, so he intentionally doesn't stop at Ephesus on the way back because he doesn't want to get delayed because he's on his way to Jerusalem. He wants to get there in time. But he does do this. He stops at Miletus, which is a town just south of Ephesus on the coast, and also a song line in an Eagles song. But I think it's a plant. I don't know. Anyway, you can look it up. But he stops at Miletus, and he sends for the Ephesian elders to come down to him. Now, this is unique. He's written letters to churches and letters to elders, but nowhere else do we see this, where Paul gets in the neighborhood, and he says, hey, get the elders from that church and bring them to me. I need to talk to them. He may have done it. It's just not recorded. This is the only place we have it recorded, where he sends the elders, and again, he does something unique. He gets the elders there in Miletus, and he basically, you can read about this towards the end of Acts 20, about a dozen verses. He basically acquits himself on his way to Jerusalem, knowing, I think, that he's going to be imprisoned before the Ephesian elders. He says, hey, I just want to point out that I work by my own hands. I didn't take your money. And he makes this statement, which is important. He says, I want you to know that I'm innocent of blood. I have preached the whole gospel to you. Okay? And so he acquits himself, and he basically says, guys, I was with you for 3 years, and I gave you everything I know. I didn't hold anything back. Whatever I have, you have it. So go with it. I'm not guilty of misleading you or of leaving anything out. And then he warns them that ravening wolves are going to come in after him. And he begins, and the warning is an admonishment to hold fast to the doctrine they've been taught. So Paul hasn't done this with anyone else. And the Ephesian elders love Paul, and they weep, and they send him on, and he goes to Jerusalem. So again, I just want you to see, this is unique. Paul has this relationship with the elders where he's going. And the other thing that's unique is I love that he tells them, I've given you the whole counsel of God. In 3 years, they've had really thorough teaching. This should be a pretty well-instructed church, right? Okay, so going on, Paul goes to Jerusalem. Now it's about 57 AD. He gets thrown in prison. You can read about it in Acts. He gets sent to Rome 2 years later, about 59 AD. You can read about that in Acts. It's pretty exciting. He gets shipwrecked. He gets a snake that bites him, and he doesn't swell up, and people are very impressed and stuff like that. He ends up in Rome and immediately gets thrown into prison there, and it's about 60 AD now, okay? So the Ephesians church, the church in Ephesus, is about 6 years old. I'm sorry, about 8 years old. And what we find when he gets to Rome is that Timothy has been with him on this whole journey, and Timothy has been with him on the second missionary journey, the third missionary journey, and with him going to Rome, and Timothy is there with him in Rome, where Paul is in prison. We see this because, what I want you to see is Timothy is with him probably at least the first 2 years. It becomes vague after that. It's one of the things that theologians argue about and that I get tired of looking at websites on. But you can only go so far. But for at least the first 2 years, AD 60 to 62, Timothy is with Paul in Rome. The reason we know this was in those 2 years, Paul writes to the Philippians, the Colossians, and the book of Philemon, to Philemon, and in each of those books, he mentions it being from him and Timothy, or that Timothy's with him. So we know that Timothy's there, okay? But what is interesting now, and the reason I keep talking about Timothy is going to come into when we get to the next passage, is, before we go to that, the other thing that happens, because we're going to be studying the book of Ephesians, the other thing that happens is it's here in prison, somewhere between 60 and 62 A.D., that Paul writes his letter to the Ephesians. Timothy isn't mentioned in the letter to Ephesians, but Timothy was there with Paul. Ephesians and Colossians are kind of parallel books. And what you need to know about these as we get ready to study Ephesians is they were referred to as circular epistles, meaning, yes, Ephesians was written to the city of Ephesus and Colossians was written to the city of Colossae, but they were meant to be circulated in the region. And so they were general instructions to the church, not necessarily specifically just for Ephesus and Colossae. They were kind of circular letters, okay? Which the reason I'm pointing that out is that's going to be in contrast to the letter that Paul writes to Timothy, which is for Timothy, okay? So he writes to the Ephesians, which we're going to start to study, from prison in Rome. Okay, and Timothy is with him at this point. Now, what happens somewhere in the next couple years, Timothy goes back to Ephesus. I don't know if, I assume Timothy and Paul talked about it. I don't know whose idea it was, but Timothy ends up back at Ephesus, and Timothy is the bishop or overseer of the church in Ephesus somewhere after 62 AD. Okay? And it's at this time that Paul, probably from Rome, maybe from Macedonia, I'll explain that in a minute, Paul writes his first and second letters of Timothy to Timothy. Paul and Timothy are separated at this point. Paul is either in Rome or Macedonia, and Timothy is back in Ephesus, being the bishop of the church of Ephesus. So now we see Timothy, not only was he there the whole time Paul was there, he's now the bishop of the church of Ephesus. Okay? Now, the reason I say Rome or Macedonia is because theologians argue. Some say Paul was martyred in Rome in 64. I lean towards Paul was martyred in Rome in 67, and that he was in prison for 3 or 4 years, was released briefly, went to Macedonia, which is northern Greece, but then was taken back to Rome to be martyred. All right? So we don't know for sure where he was, but he wasn't in Ephesus, and he wasn't with Timothy. He's writing to Timothy. All right? Now, at the end of 2 Timothy, Paul asked Timothy to come to him, and we don't have any Bible on what happened here, but tradition says that he went and he returned back to Ephesus after Paul was martyred in 67 AD. All right? And that he continued as the bishop of Ephesus until he was martyred there in 97 AD, which is roughly the same time that we were getting the book of Revelation from the Apostle John. So, the testimony that Timothy was martyred at Ephesus comes from Fox's Book of Martyrs, so it's pretty good, all right? So, we've seen incredible influence Paul had on Ephesus, Now we see that Timothy has actually been the bishop or overseer of Ephesus, and Paul's written to him about it. And just for fun, the Apostle John, and remember, this is tradition, but remember, he has Mary, the mother of Jesus, with him, because at the cross, Jesus said, take care of her, and he said, got it. So that's going on. So the Apostle John, with Mary, the mother of Jesus, comes to Ephesus just before 70 AD. Remember, 70 AD is when Rome destroys Jerusalem and destroys the temple, and people flee, and persecution, and Masada, and all that stuff happens, right? So just before that, as if he'd been warned in some way, the Apostle John has picked up stakes and moved to Ephesus. We don't know how much before, but just before. And so he's there. Now, so we have John and Timothy both at Ephesus. Various websites or texts will refer to John as the pastor of Ephesus or Timothy as the pastor of Ephesus or the bishop of Ephesus. I don't know. I figure it's probably like me and Gary. John was older, so maybe he was retired and just doing IT like Gary does here. And Timothy was, bishoping. I don't know. I'm just guessing. So we'll get Gary's opinion later. Anyway, while John is there, he writes his three epistles, 1st, 2nd, 3rd John. And he is imprisoned at Patmos, but after Patmos, after he's released Patmos, where he has his revelation of Jesus Christ, he comes back to Ephesus and probably dies there. Interestingly, the first letter to, the seven letters to the seven churches in the book of Revelation, all seven of those churches are in Asia Minor and would have been sort of under John's purview in terms of, at least in his circle of influence. And the first one addressed is the church at Ephesus. And what the address is, just to remind you, is God says, you're doing good works, kudos. You're really standing for holiness. You're testing people. You're not putting up with false doctrine, kudos. But you've lost your first love. So you need to return to that place of intimacy. That's basically the message to the church in Ephesus. Okay? Now, that is the best I can do at placing you in Ephesus. So you get a feel for what it's like to live there. There'll actually be a little bit more of that as we get into talking about Artemis. Now, let's jump to Paul's first letter or epistle to Timothy, and we want to look at those first two chapters. Now, keep in mind, the Ephesian church, at the point where Timothy is there, being the bishop of Ephesus, and Paul's writing him a letter, the Ephesian church is about 10 years old, roughly. It's been about 10 years since Paul showed up and started teaching in the dinosaur school. And so they ought to have some maturity, but 10 years isn't a real long time in the life of a church. So they don't have it all wired yet. And here's what Paul writes to Timothy. Paul, who loves Ephesus, who spent 3 years there, who knows Ephesus really well, writing to Timothy, who spent the same 3 years there and is there now being the bishop of the church, who knows Ephesus really well. Paul's writing to him to encourage him. And here's what we get. In the first chapter, it's the admonition is just sound doctrine. Hold on to sound doctrine. Teach sound doctrine. Hold fast to sound doctrine. Make sure that they have sound doctrine, okay? And then he jumps into chapter 2, and chapter 2 is split into two parts. The first 8 verses are Paul's admonition that men should pray, and the second half of the chapter, verses 9 through 15, are about what women ought to be up to and what women ought to not be up to. So there's the men half and the women half, all right? Now, incidentally, if you think Paul has a problem with women, we're not going to go there, but in chapter 5 of 1 Timothy, he specifically is directing the honor and respect of women be taught. So it's pretty clear he doesn't have a problem with women, despite what you've read. I think Paul liked women fine. Wanted them to be honored and respected. But this is the passage that people have difficulty with, so we're going to look at it. Now, I will say this, though. I find it interesting that the first part of Timothy 2, 1 Timothy 2, admonishes men. That's where it says, I would that men pray everywhere, lifting up holy hands with wrath or downing. You just have to beat those against something when that happens. All right. Anyway, I find it interesting that in the first half of 2 Timothy, he calls men to prayer. In the second half, depending on your translation, it says women be silent. I find it interesting that men get offended when women usurp their place of teaching in the church, but I've never yet met a man who was offended by women usurping their place of prayer in the church. Don't you find that interesting? How many of you have been to lots of church prayer meetings? You notice that they're predominantly men? And you're all laughing because it's exactly the opposite, isn't it? So my thing on 1 Timothy 2 is, men, if you're going to get bent about the second part, get serious about the first part. Right? Don't let them, if you don't want them taking your place in the pulpit, don't let them take your place in the prayer room either. All right, enough of that. Let's move on. So, let's look at this difficult passage that's been argued about and all that stuff. And 1 Timothy 2, verses 9 through 15. It says, in like manner also, that the women adorn themselves in modest apparel with propriety and moderation, not with braided hair, gold, or pearls, or costly clothing, but which is proper for women professing godliness with good works. Let a woman learn in silence with all submission. That's where it gets tough. And I do not permit a woman to teach or to have authority over a man, but to be in silence. For Adam was formed first, then Eve, and Adam was not deceived, but the woman being deceived fell into transgression. Nevertheless, she will be saved in childbearing if they continue in faith, love, and holiness with self-control. Now, here's what happens with this passage. Even the people who believe this means women shut it have a hard time when they get to the end going, I don't know how Paul got to childbearing. I don't know what's going on here. I don't make the connection. It just seems like Paul's having a senior moment, and they're just non sequiturs coming out. Be quiet, and by the way, childbirth. Right? And so we're looking for the connection. Well, there actually is a connection, and here it comes. Well, in a minute. First, let's summarize. There are basically 3 points here that I want to summarize because I want to deal with each of these. One, he's dealing with adornment, modest apparel versus braided hair, gold, pearls, costly clothes. Two, silent submission, no teaching or authority. Just be still and mind your own business. And three, for some odd reason, he goes to Adam and Eve and kids, and it says, Adam came first. Eve was the one that was deceived, not Adam, but you'll be saved in childbearing. All right? Now, all of these will make sense in a minute, but I want you to consider this. Remember, this is a letter written to Timothy, pastoring Ephesus. Paul wrote the letter to the Ephesians and the parallel letter to the Colossians, where he dealt with things like marriage and the structure of the church. I find it interesting that if this is such an important doctrine, specifically number two, women teaching or not having authority in the church, I find it interesting that he failed to address it in Ephesians or Colossians. There's nothing about it there. In fact, this is the only place it's ever addressed in the New Testament. So, makes me wonder, and it leads to, and I'm going to give you basis for this in a minute, my conclusion that it was only written to Timothy because it has a cultural application, i.e., it's specifically for the church of Ephesus, not for all the churches. And that's why I just wrote to Timothy. Now, I do want to say this. I want to be very, very, very careful about playing the cultural card because it's so easy. It's a slippery slope, and people go too far, and you play the cultural card, and the next thing you know, you're adapting the Word of God to your culture, and you end up with a lot of what we have in the church today, people changing the Word of God to fit culture. or people going back and saying, well, they meant that because of that culture, but our culture's different, so they don't mean that anymore. And that's most of the time not the case. So I only play the cultural card when, to me, it's very clear that it's culture. And in this case, I think it's very clear. And I'm going to give you the reasons now, okay? I think Paul was writing to Timothy about a situation in the church in Ephesus, not to all the churches. Here we go. And here's where you're going to get some history, Peloponnesian War, stuff like that. If you like history, great. If you don't, try and stay awake. Okay. Artemis worship. Artemis was the goddess of nature, of fertility. So if you wanted babies, you need to get Artemis involved. Of maidens, young women. Artemis was an eternal virgin. Obviously, we don't believe that there actually was an Artemis, but, you know, they believed Artemis was an eternal virgin. Here's the big one. I underline this. Artemis was the goddess of childbirth. Big deal. They didn't have emergency rooms. You had kids, and hopefully a midwife showed up and helped you. So if you weren't worshiping Artemis, your kid might die in childbirth, or your childbirth might not go well. You might die in childbirth. Artemis was your medical insurance plan for maternity, okay? So Artemis was the goddess of childbirth. This is a very big deal to the women. And this is important. Artemis had the ability to author life, and she was thought of as the author of men. Where did men come from? Artemis. Artemis, the author of life. Artemis makes men. Artemis authors men. Got it? It's important that we understand these. Now, let's look at how this influences thinking. Peloponnesian Wars. For those of you who aren't up on your ancient Greek history, and I wasn't either, that's what we have the internet for. The Peloponnesian Wars lasted about 27 years, and it was Greece had city-states, and Athens and Sparta, just a little bit south of Athens, were at war. And then various other city-states were aligned with one of these two powers, and this was the Peloponnesian Wars. Now, and they had an impact on Greece. Now, Sparta, in around 400 BC, defeats Athens, and Athens is kind of a wreck and is no longer much of an influence at that time in Greece. And so Sparta gains influence in Greece, all right? Now, here's where this took me, because I started going, well, how, I'm getting ready to look at how women are looked at in Ephesus, which was a Greek city. So I went, okay, well, how are women looked at in Greece? And if you go and look at how women were looked at in Greece, you initially find they were looked at like they were looked at everywhere in the world at that time. They were property. They were not given education. They were subjugated. Except if you go to Sparta, and it's very different. Remember, Sparta won. Sparta gained influence. So here's what we see. In Athens, for example, women are property. They're subservient. And boys went to school. Girls didn't. All right? If you go to Sparta, women have rights. They got the same education that men got. Very progressive for a 400 BC Greek city-state. They were educated, and motherhood, catch this, motherhood was the equivalent of military service. Mothers were given the same honor that soldiers were given. And Sparta was a warrior culture. So, high honor to motherhood, all right? So that's what's going on. That's the difference between Sparta and Athens. Remember, Sparta won and began to have influence. So I go, okay, well, what gods were they into? Well, this is interesting. Athens had the Parthenon, which was a temple to the goddess Athena. If you go look at Sparta, they had the sanctuary of Artemis Orthia, which is basically Orthia transferring into Artemis. So who did they worship? Identical. It's Orthia and Artemis are identical. It's all the same worship, the fertility goddess, childbirth, creator of men, all that stuff. So I go, huh, interesting. Sparta had the sanctuary of Artemis. So Sparta, with this elevation of women, also were Artemis worshipers. So my next question was, Well, who was Ephesus more influenced by, Sparta or Athens? Well, guess what I learned? Ephesus was allied with Sparta. In fact, so closely allied that 2 years before the Peloponnesian Wars ended, the Spartan Navy was in port in Ephesus, and there's this Battle of Notium where the Athenian Navy had barricaded a man, and they actually came out and won a minor victory, and it led to a naval officer being demoted and another one being promoted, and then they, within 2 years, they'd won the war. So their navy actually was in Ephesus. So it seems like there was a pretty significant link between Ephesus and Sparta, both of these people being Artemis worshipers. Are you with me? Now, here's the fun part. Again, if you like history or if you just like recent movies, Gorgo, the queen of Sparta, you may, if you watched The 300, which I'm not necessarily recommending, I think it's like rated R in a heavy way, but Gorgo was the queen of Sparta at this time. It's she was the wife of Leonidas, and she was the daughter of a king. She married a king. Her son was a king. She had a lot of influence in Sparta. Leonidas was the famous king during the Battle of Thermopylae, which is when Persia came over and tried to invade Greece, and the 300 Spartans at Thermopylae held them off long enough for the rest of Greece to get their act together, and Greece wasn't conquered by Persia. You guys probably have heard of that story. If not, there's the movie. But here's the point. This is a quote, and there's not a whole lot of women from this time who are quoted, but here's a quote from Gorgo, queen of Sparta, on women. When asked, why are you Spartan women the only ones who can rule men? Now, first of all, what does that tell you their reputation was in Sparta? That they could rule over men. Everywhere else in the world, this isn't happening, but in Sparta, women are ruling over men. And her answer is, because we are also the only ones who give birth to men. Do you hear the Artemis theology in there? We create them, and we rule them, because we create them. Right? I'm not going to make any comments about marriage or anything like that. But sons, keep that in mind. All right. So, let's take this now, what we know. We see this heavy Artemis influence. Now, all of Greece would have worshipped Artemis at some level, maybe as a secondary god. But in Ephesus, they were all in on Artemis. Remember, 2 hours, great is Diana of the Ephesians. They were all in on Artemis. They were serious about their Artemis worship. They were radical, maybe even a little cultish, okay? So if any place you're going to find pure, unadulterated Artemisness, this is it. All right? Now, let's look at some of the specifics of Artemis worship. And this is interesting. Sometimes what will happen in the Bible is you'll have Greek words that don't occur a whole lot. And so we're not sure exactly what they mean. And they'll go to other Greek literature at the time and see if that word occurs. And we'll shed light on what the word means to help us translate it. We know a whole bunch about Artemis worship because a guy named Xenophon, does that sound like a sci-fi name or what? Xenophon of Ephesus wrote this novel back about 50 AD, just before Paul came to Ephesus, called Ephesiaca. And in it, it's about a young couple. It's just a romance story. It's a love story. It's a novel. We believe it's the oldest novel we have still in existence. But it's just a novel about a young couple, and apparently it was pretty well known. Shakespeare used it, at least in part, when he was writing. He based Romeo and Juliet, roughly, on this novel about a young couple from different, I think in this case it was different strata of society, coming together, all right? But what's interesting is in this novel, because it's set in Ephesus, we have all this information about what Artemis worship looked like. And I didn't go read the novel. I just read excerpts and I read things that people who read the novel said and all that good stuff because, you know, I only have so much time to learn about Artemis. Anyway, here's what I learned. Let's go through these 3 points again. One, the adornment, modest apparel versus braided hair, golden pearls, and costly clothing. Well, here's what we learned, that devotion to Artemis was shown through appearance, through dress. In fact, when Paul talks about that braided hairstyle, it's actually one of those Greek words. It's pretty rare. But if we go to the Ephesiaca, the exact same Greek word is in that book, referring to not just hairstyles in general, but a specific hairstyle. What they did, I think, was they just looked at the statue of Diana, and she had like braided hair with pearls in it, and they went, that's it. If you worship Diana, you do your hair that way. So they were braiding their hair with pearls as a sign of their devotion to Artemis. Understand? It might change the way we look at this passage. All right? And Paul's exhorting them to not do that and not wear costly clothing. By the way, Artemis was the guardian of their wealth and everything. So wealth was a way of showing, if you wore nice clothes, it was a way of showing piety. It's basically an early prosperity gospel. Look, I worship Artemis. See how good I'm doing? Artemis is responsible for my wealth. And so it reflected well on Artemis if you wore costly clothing. And you could just walk the city and go, oh, Artemis worshiper, see the braids with the pearls, right? So it's really not about hair. So I'm going to give you this out right off the bat, ladies. Go ahead and get your hair done and buy some nice clothes. It's okay. Just don't buy any expensive outfits that specifically worship a Greek or Roman gods. Good? All right, I want you to feel free. Rachel's going to be very excited about the shopping part of this message. Two, and this is really the big deal here, silent submission, no teaching or authority. Well, in Artemis worship, obviously women led. Women priestesses were high up because it was kind of a early feminist movement thing. And as women were being trained, they were encouraged in loud vocal debate. All right? So what's going on is not just, hey, be silent. Their whole training is, so imagine you're an Artemis worshiper and you get saved and you come to church and all you know is the way you do religion is we have loud vocal debate. All right? Now, if someone came here this morning like that, they would probably already interrupted me by now. So, ladies, no loud vocal debate. And by the way, men, no loud vocal debate during my teaching. Okay? We can do it later. But right now, no. You understand the message that's coming out here. Now, by the way, this is also interesting, and I don't know why these things happen. I don't know. Maybe the guys translating the modern translations, the New King James or whatever, I don't know what their wives were like. I don't know why they did this. But I don't know why they use silent for the Greek word there. The Greek word can easily and probably should be translated quiet or tranquil, not silent. There is the Greek word for silent elsewhere in the Bible. This is not that word. In fact, just a few verses earlier where Paul says, I would men everywhere lift up holy hands without wrath or doubting in prayer so that you may live quiet and peaceable lives. Exact same word in that verse is translated quiet. A few verses later is translated silence. Exact same Greek word. Don't know why they decided to use silent there. Again, I'm thinking somebody's wife was just being annoying and he went, I'm putting silent there. But that's just my theory. So it clearly should be read quiet, not silent. And by the way, and even quiet in the sense of tranquil, not like quiet in the sense of whispering. Okay? So again, it's that loud debate thing. And by the way, I don't know how you would have silent prophetesses, but I found at least 10 specific examples of prophetesses in the Bible, and I think they have to talk to qualify. I'm guessing, unless they have to prophesy outside of church and then send it in. But In Acts chapter 2, we're told that God will pour out His Spirit on all flesh, and our maidservants and our daughters will prophesy. So I think they're going to do that some in church. So and in fact, in 1 Corinthians 11, Paul is talking about women prophesying in church. And so clearly, silent does not mean silent. That's just easy. So we should get over that. So Sandy, you're okay. All right. Now, the part about submission, we don't need this passage for. It's already covered both in Ephesians 5 and Colossians 3. Wives, submit to your husbands. I would point out that it doesn't say women submit to every man in the earth. It says wives, submit to your man. So possibly the submission is to her man or any valid authority. So again, even if you're not married to me, if you start asking me questions in the middle of teaching, I might make you submit to me and be quiet, right? But again, I'll do that for the guys also, not just the women. You understand what's going on. It's just standard submission. Now, let's get to the really hard part. I underlined it, to teach or have authority. And these words are linked by the verb, so to teach with authority or whatever. It gets very complex here, and I got really tired of looking at Greek, and because since I don't do Greek, I have to depend on others, so let's keep that in mind. I'm not a Greek expert or even a novice, or I don't even like Greek yogurt, so just that's all you get. But here's what I learned, all right? The Greek word used here for have authority, authenteo, is very unique. It occurs only once in this place. It's the only place this occurs in the New Testament, all right? And there are other words for authority, but they're not used, only this one. And so no one is really sure what it means. And so they've had to go, again, to other sources, to other Greek writings of the time to try and see where is this word used and what does it mean. Most of the scholars agree that it's used in the negative sense. And what that means is authority can be positive. You know, Gary, exercise authority over Church on the Rock as an elder and as a pastor. That's good. But the negative sense is really, it probably would best be translated domineering. That's a negative sense of authority. So I agree. Women, don't be domineering. Men, don't be domineering either. Elders and pastors and myself and people in legitimate roles of authority, don't be domineering. I don't have any problem with that, right? But it does shed light on probably what was going on at that time in that culture with the way women had been trained. So at best, it's talking about don't be domineering in an authoritative way. It actually might be different than that. The other thing that this word might mean is author or originator. In fact, in some places, and this is just how weird it gets, in some places in the Greek use in other places, it's used. This word is used for murder, or to the opposite to originate life, to take life. So it means murder. So there's actually even one theory, and this one isn't widely held, that this verse is actually not saying, I don't permit women to teach or have authority over men, but it leans more on the author-originator meaning of the word, that this verse is saying, I don't permit women to teach that they're the author of men, which is what? Artemis theology. Okay? Now, let's go to verse 3. Adam came first, then Eve was deceived, they'll be saved in childbearing. Artemis theology. Women came first and are superior. Men brought evil, and Artemis protects you in childbirth. Right? Three main tenets of Artemis theology. Is it possible, and remember how weird this passage seems on its face, but then when you begin to throw in the culture, the Artemis culture of the day, you go, oh, well, that totally makes sense. He's dealing with Artemis stuff. He's going, you can't teach. He's going, don't dress like you're an Artemis worshiper. Don't teach. Don't be overbearing what was the word I used? Domineering in your learning style, and don't teach that women are the author of men. Women didn't come first. Men came first. Adam. Men didn't cause evil. Remember, Eve sinned first. Adam went right along, but Eve sinned first. And you'll be saved in childbirth. You don't need Artemis for childbirth. Jesus will take care of you. Now it all kind of makes sense, doesn't it? So I can't be dogmatic about this, but I think we have a pretty good case here that Paul was specifically addressing Artemis worship in Ephesus, not telling women to shut up. Okay? Now, you can believe otherwise, if your wife lets you, and that's all good. But I will say this. I think it's incredibly unwise to establish dogma on a single debatable verse. Maybe if the verse was very clear. But just go play with the Greek for a while on the internet. It is not clear. It's a single debatable verse. I would not be dogmatic about a doctrine based on this one passage. And there are no other passages that call for women to be silent. There are other passages that call for submission, both to men and women, in the appropriate ways, right? Okay, so that was fun, because I like history. I hope you had fun. And it's not often you get to work the Peloponnesian Wars into a sermon. So there you have it. So women, I'm putting my foot down. No teaching pagan Artemis worship at Church on the Rock. Does everyone understand? All right. Otherwise, you know, and listen, obviously we have women teach, we have women speak all the time. Most churches I see don't have a problem with women not being silent. Women speak. Some churches don't let women teach. We do. Obviously, you can tell where we're at on it. Again, if you want to differ and go to a church that believes that, you'll have to go somewhere else because we're going to let women teach. But it's all good. You believe what you want. I just wanted to give you a case for it that I believe is rational and makes sense because we want to study to show ourselves approved. Amen? All right. I'm betting Paul's up there going, man, I wish I'd have said that different. All right.